Most of the guests on Operate with Zen are established surgeons or professionals who are in various stages of integrating mindfulness or intentional practices into their lives. Dr. Jake Taylor is smack in the middle of surgical training. He's a chief resident at NYU in urology, but he has an established mindfulness practice and philosophy. In this episode of Operate with Zen, we explore the integration of mindfulness, yoga, and being present into surgical training, an episode that will benefit listeners of all training levels and mindfulness expertise. My name is Phil Perazio, and I'm a urologic oncologist, a surgeon. Like many of you, I absolutely love what I do, and I would not choose another profession. But I have struggled with professional identity, practice efficiency, and wellness over the years. Operate with Zen is a podcast designed to explore a mindful approach to surgery and to being a surgeon. By discussing these struggles and mindful solutions, I hope together we can create a community of strong and healthy surgeons. Enjoy. All right, and welcome to Operate with Zen. I've got the pleasure of being joined today with Dr. Jake Taylor. Jake, introduce yourself to everybody.
Well, thanks, Phil. Excited to be talking to you today. My name is Jake Taylor, and these days I would say foremost, I'm a father and husband. My wife gave birth to our healthy baby boy, Mackenzie, 7 weeks ago today. So needless to say, he's consuming our world these days. Other than that, I'm also one of the chief residents in urology at NYU Langone Health, and come July, will be the urologic oncology fellow at UT Southwestern.
Well, excellent. So Jake and I have had the pleasure of running into each other in the urologic oncology circles, sharing some research projects together, and honestly talking a bunch of mindfulness. So Jake, give us a little bit of your personal background and your unique experience with mindfulness, and we'll get into it.
Yeah, so mindfulness in the form of meditation has been a part of my awareness and subconscious awareness for my entire life. Both my parents are avid meditators. My dad right now actually is doing a week-long silent meditation retreat. And I grew up in somewhat of a, I would say, polytheistic household with my parents coming from Jewish and Christian upbringings. But when I was young, they ascribed to many Buddhist beliefs and habits, beliefs such as nonviolence, mindfulness, compassion as ways towards happiness and fulfillment. And so it wasn't until I started on my journey with yoga, roughly close to a decade ago now, did I really start to learn for myself what mindfulness was, how important it is, and how I could incorporate it into my everyday life. So for me, mindfulness is a psycho-emotional technique to center oneself, to deal with the stresses of life in a more thoughtful, grateful, and caring manner. Mindfulness seems to help me be more aware of the present moment. And as surgeons, as doctors, as you know, we have a plethora of external stimuli, which raises a variety of those emotions. And mindfulness techniques can allow us to respond to those stimuli in a less reactive and a more thoughtful way. So I've really been in the mindfulness area for a long time. And I'm now, as I move on to these next steps of my career, and more focused in looking how we will and how I will utilize mindfulness in my future practice. And I know we'll get into that a little more.
Yeah, so that's great. And so I want to work through a little bit through your chronology. So as a kid growing up with mindful parents, how did they introduce these concepts to you? How did they work it into your life? And how did they teach you or train you or whatever, you know, terminology you want to use here?
Yeah, so foremost, it was observation. So growing up, I would see my mom in our living room, meditating, being quiet. And I would see how she would be in the world and how she would take moments of pause to be thoughtful in certain situations or in her responses to me. And then it sort of grew off of just being aware to bringing me to various personal development, let's say workshops or day-long symposiums, where mindfulness and spirituality were a big part of those trainings. And how could you be more in touch with your own spirit, your own emotions, in order to really just be a better person in the world and achieve what you wanted to do?
I think that's really cool. You know, one of the reasons I started this podcast is just to normalize talking about these things, that we should be talking about these things. There is more to surgery than just what suture you're using and what are the steps of the operation. And, you know, I think your parents did the same thing, right? They normalized mindfulness and, you know, kind of behavior of being a good person and incorporating into it. I'm trying to figure this all out now. I have two young girls and, you know, it's, I try not to inundate them with anything. But I just try and expose them to what I'm doing and what's going on. And listen, every morning I wake up and I do yoga and I meditate. And if they wake up early enough, sometimes I end up with a child hanging off my back, sometimes surprising and sometimes not, because sometimes they're quiet and sometimes they're not. But I think they know that it's okay to do these things and think about these things. And, you know, if they ever ask about breathing techniques or things to talk about, I'm here for them, but I don't push it on them yet.
Yeah. And I think you'll be surprised as they grow older, 5, 10, 15 years from now, they will probably take up a lot of those habits that you're doing now just on their own. And at least for myself growing up as a kid, as many kids, sometimes we're resistant to a lot of those philosophies or practices that we see in our parents or think that they're silly. But 20 years later, here I am meditating and doing yoga and doing a lot of these mindfulness things that maybe sometimes when I was younger, I poo-pooed a little bit for my parents.
Yeah, it's true. Some people do, you know, I have this goat yoga. I joke, I do Cammy yoga every once in a while because I'll be downstairs doing something, not really looking. And all of a sudden a five-year-old comes and is climbing on my back. And as hard as yoga poses can be, they can be even harder with a five-year-old hanging off you. But you'll get there soon, Jake. You'll get that figured out.
Yeah, I imagine. I'm told that it's not quite safe yet to do it with a two-month-old, but I'm sure that day will come soon.
It will come sooner than you realize. Enjoy the moment. So next step in your evolution, I don't want to jump too far ahead, so you back me up if I need to, but you talked about yoga about 10 years ago and really getting into yoga practice. So bring us up to speed there. Give us your yoga story, how you got into it, and how you think it has benefited you and plays into your life now.
Yeah, so as I said, I've been doing yoga for close to 10 years. I mean, going back 15, 20 years ago, I was doing pointed and active stretching in a very focused way for my tennis. But yoga itself, I've been doing for about 10 years. Started it in my graduate program after college. But it wasn't really until the past 5 years or so when I started and soon will now be completing my urologic residency training that I really started to also deepen my yoga practice. And we often call yoga moving meditation. So what I once used as a mere complement in my exercise routine, I now used as a central part of my life and habits to really center myself and cultivate mindfulness. So yeah, I love getting on my mat and moving and stretching and feeling a lot of the aches and pains, which as I get older are more frequent, unfortunately. But more than anything, it's using my breath. It's cultivating that mindfulness. It's letting go of everything else that I have brought onto the mat that particular day. And I've really developed and learned a lot of the principles from yoga and have kind of brought that into my training as sort of fallbacks. And I find those very useful.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I've gotten really into yoga, not quite 10 years, but I'd say over the last two and a half years, I've really gotten heavy into it. And it's part of my, as you said, it's part of who I am now. It's part of my daily practice. Every day, I'm at least doing small amounts of yoga, and we can get into what's the right amount. But I agree with you. I initially started it just for flexibility and strength. I thought I was too stiff in the operating room. I didn't like the way my back felt. I thought it would potentially help me feel better. And it does. And so there are physical benefits to this. And then, so even if you have no interest in any of the other parts of this, yoga is a great way to get flexibility and strength in your core, which I think are hugely beneficial for surgeons. But then along comes everything else that you sometimes don't even realize you pick up until you pick it up. There's breathing, there's body awareness, there's really being present, like you said, getting everything else of the day out. And I actually do my yoga first thing in the morning when I wake up. I find it's the best way to wake up my mind and body. I don't look at phones. I don't look at my Apple Watch. I don't look at anything. I get up, I grab my mat. Well, I go to the bathroom first because I'm older than you. Yoga, meditate, and then I start my day. Then I pick up the phone. Then I'm ready for email. Then I'm ready for coffee and ready for all these other things. So everybody's got their own routine. Tell us, you know, what's your routine? I know it's hard during training to potentially do it on a daily basis, but what's your routine?
So I'll say what's interesting is over the past 2 years with the amount of, you know, changes that have gone on in everybody's life, my routine has changed pretty frequently. At the beginning of the pandemic, I was doing yoga every day and I was probably feeling better than maybe I ever had. And then I think maybe about a year ago or so, I fell off a little bit and I started to really gear up for fellowship applications and applying and interviewing and went back to, you know, full time and full speed at the hospital. And so I wasn't doing it every day. And I found myself not feeling as good. And eventually I was getting a little burned out because that was also the time, like I said, where I was gearing up my application. So I was working on, you know, 10 or 12 different projects and trying to beef up that resume. And so it's interesting now to look back on it and say, oh yeah, I was getting burned out, but I was also, you know, not doing the yoga. I was not doing the important self work that I needed to really fill my own tank before I did all those other things. And so now I'm getting back into the routine, certainly with a 7-week-old newborn, it's tough. But I'm doing it as much as I can, pretty much, whenever there's a break or an off evening. I haven't quite gotten to the 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. wake up yet, to do it before I start my day. But we'll see if I'm able to do that in the next, you know, few months or so.
Good. And 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, what's your routine? Just so people kind of understand what it can or cannot take to kind of do this.
Yeah, I think the great part about yoga is there's so much non-judgment, I think, in a lot of the yoga space. There certainly is some judgment in some yoga spaces, and I try to avoid those areas. But for the most part, yoga is based in non-judgment. And so for me, it's anything, really. If I get on my mat and I do one sun salutation, I qualify that as a success. If I get on the mat and I do some breathing for a few minutes, that's a success. The other day I started, I think it was a 35-minute class, and 15 or 17 minutes through, I was not feeling it. I was not feeling the groove. I was not jiving. And so I stopped and I got off, but I was still doing yoga and I still felt better. Ultimately, I didn't feel bad about it. So I think any amount of time is fine. I think the ideal to really get a lot of those therapeutic and physical benefits is probably anywhere between 30 and 60 minutes. And that's usually what I strive for.
Good. What do you use apps online? What do you use for your classes now?
Yeah. So I was really lucky. My wife is a trained Broadway dancer who's now transitioned to a full-time yoga teacher. So during the pandemic, I had my own personal yoga teacher for a lot of the time, but then, you know, she got sick of me. So now she's going back to classes and going back to teaching. But I do a lot of the online classes, especially now. I try to avoid the studio as much as I can. Right now I'm practicing with Commune Yoga, a studio that's based out in Seattle. They're just fantastic.
Very cool. Yeah. I'm a Peloton person, so I end up using the Peloton app a fair amount. The Nike app is also pretty phenomenal. And YouTube, you could find some decent YouTube stuff if you can't pay or don't want to pay for some of these classes. And I'll tell you, people ask me all the time, how do you get started? Start off really small, like you said. 5 minutes. You can start with a 5 minute yoga class and just work on kind of some of the basics. And from 5 minutes, when you feel more comfortable, then go to 10. And like you said, I think the ideal spot is somewhere in the range of half an hour, plus or minus. But I will tell you, there's some days I wake up and I just know it's going to be a rough day and I'm already anxious about the day. And if I do a half hour, 45 minutes, I'm going to feel more anxious. So you know what? 15, 20 minutes is okay. As long as I do something, I know that that's a headspace I can deal with and deal with efficiently and then kind of move on.
Yeah. And as you said, there's so many resources. I too started on YouTube. I was looking to supplement my weightlifting regimen with some stretching. And so I would do 10 to 15 minutes of a YouTube guided class, which was really helpful. And I think a lot of people get anxiety or roadblock of not being able to start on yoga because they don't know where to begin. They think it's this big black box and they're not really sure what it is, or think that it's just for women or what have you. But yeah, I started following this guy on YouTube and stretched for 10 to 15 minutes. And that was actually how I first initially got into it.
That's great. And I think one of the nice things too, you know, you mentioned classes and it's really tough during the pandemic, but I think one of the nice things about classes are when you feel like you're in a rut or you've had enough YouTube or you kind of feel like you're plateauing, you can get yourself involved in a class. They're always unique. It's always a different experience. You're going to see other people around you. And it's a good way to just kind of jumpstart if you're feeling flat. Or the other time I like to do it is traveling, right? We all go to the hotel and the hotel gym's decent, but I guarantee you can find a yoga studio within 10, 15 minutes. And for $10 to $20, sign up for an in-person class. And it's just something to kind of enhance your vacation or your time away. That's one of the other tricks I picked up. And I fully credit Scott Egner for that one. He's always been a kind of a big fan of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you on that one. Pretty much every vacation I've gone on in the last 5 years or so, we try to find a local yoga studio to see what they're all about. And it's been amazing to see different spaces, different people's practices. So yeah, I fully support that as well.
Yeah. So residency's tough. My residency was tough. I'm sure your residency is tough and, you know, it's coming to an end. And so tell us, you know, about mindfulness in residency. And, you know, we talked about the yoga and the meditation stuff, but if you don't mind, reflect a little bit more on how you use it almost on a day-to-day with the good and bad that goes on with residency.
Yeah. So as I said before, I really have developed, or at least have taken, some of those yoga principles and try to utilize them in my everyday life. And I use them to fall back on when the training does get tough and stressful. And so one of those principles is enjoying the journey. Life and training is not just about the destination. And I think they teach you a lot about that on the mat, about getting into a certain pose or getting into a more complex pose. But certainly in training, that's true too. It's enjoy the now. Intern year, yeah, is tough. Being a junior is tough. So is being a chief. And if you're always looking toward the next step, if you're looking toward fellowship, if you're looking toward attendingship, you're going to miss all of those important steps before you. So for me, having that presence and that mindfulness and really trying to bring my awareness back to the moment to enjoy each of those stepping stones has been really helpful. The second sort of principle is compassion for others. You know, we are all human beings connected on a deep level. And sort of this concept of oneness that people in the yoga community talk about a lot is very important, because I try to treat my patients as I would treat my family members. And so on a day-to-day level, I'm trying to find that compassion. And yes, it's hard, especially when it's, you know, hour 15 or 16, or when you have another 10 patients to see after that patient, but really trying to meet the patient where they are and see them as a reflection of, you know, the human fabric that you're also a part of. The third principle I would say is everything is temporary. And that kind of goes back to principle number one. If the training that you're in now is difficult, that's okay, because it's going to pass. And maybe there'll be a valley of an easier time before you, or maybe there'll be a more difficult time in your future, but everything is temporary. And so I find a lot of comfort in that pretty often. And then I would say the last principle that I use probably the most frequently is the importance of breath. And I really have started to use this more in a focused way over the past couple of years as I've deepened my practice, particularly before a big case that I might be nervous about, or before doing a new part of a case, which as an aspiring oncologist, that might be dissecting on the aorta or something of that nature. It's really taking a few breaths. And I think the beautiful thing about mindfulness, and something that I think a lot of people don't realize, is that that breath work can happen at any time. I think there's this notion that you have to meditate or you have to do breath work in a dark room on your mat, quiet for 30 minutes in silence. And I don't really ascribe to that notion. For me, taking those breaths sometimes is in the elevator. Sometimes it's in the corner of the operating room. Sometimes it's on my walk to work. And that really centers myself, brings me a little calm, and helps me take a few moments to lower my heart rate, think about what I have to do in that moment or in the preceding moments. And so using my breath has really been, I would say, a key, particularly in training when things get stressful or when there's a new hurdle that I have to face.
I think that's great, Jake. And I want to tackle each one of your points, but let's stick here a little bit on the breathing for a moment, because I think this is something where there's some real practical skills that can be gained from mindfulness and meditation and yoga practices here. And it's really one of the benefits I've picked up from yoga. I always felt, even for years, I ran and I worked out, and I always would listen to the instructor say, breathe in when you're doing this exercise and breathe out when you're squeezing that muscle. And I was always off. And I always felt that it maybe hindered me a little bit. Even when I ran New York Marathon when I was in your situation, when I was a medical student and trainee in New York, and I could never get the breathing down. I feel like in the last 2 years, I finally got breathing down, and what a difference it makes, not only on the yoga mat, but I think kind of in everyday life. And I think one of the beautiful things about yogic philosophy are these dichotomies, this kind of up and down. And you talked about it before, you know, you're in the pose and you've got, you know, a deep stretch, but you've also got some squeeze associated with another muscle groups and maybe some pain associated with it, but it's all kind of working towards a beneficial, good outcome. And there's all these sides of it. And we see those dichotomies in surgery too all the time. And I talk to my trainees, residents and fellows, if you want to do big cases and big cancer cases, somebody's life is going to depend on you not only being good, but being good and fast. And the dichotomy there is, to be good and fast, you actually need to slow things down. And one of the great ways to slow things down is to breathe, right? Slow your heart rate down, slow your breathing down, kind of take in the situation rather than accelerating and potentially causing more problems than when you're already dealing with. So I love that metaphor, that analogy. I don't know if you have any comments or you want to tell people, you know, kind of how you, are there any breathing exercises you use or do on a regular basis?
For me, the breathing exercises is pretty simple. It's 3 to 5 slow, deep breaths, usually in through the nose and out through the mouth. And as you said, I think slowing it down is really important, and being efficient is really important. And I think there's a lot of new research coming out in this area, which is really exciting. There was some work by the UCSF group that actually took medical students and implemented a mindfulness 8-week long, I think, program. And after that program, the residents who had the mindfulness program were more efficient in their critical thinking. Their emotional kind of reactivity was lowered. So I think that we're going to see more and more in the future how important mindfulness is, and especially as surgeons, when those situations in the operating room come up, how can you be the calm one? How can you, as you said, slow things down, take a moment, and have that clear-minded thinking to, you know, help the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And I love holding this book up for the skeptics and anybody. This is Altered Traits by Daniel Goleman and Richard Davidson. This is for all the skeptics in medicine out there. This book talks about how meditation and mindfulness actually changes your biology. So yeah, we know it can change your behavior and the way you feel and think, but that's kind of soft science. In this book, it talks about how actually your neuroanatomy will change, how your body chemistries can change in terms of kind of cortisol production and kind of stress responses. And it actually talks about epigenetics and how they did a number of studies where with prolonged meditation and mindfulness practices, you can actually change who you are at a genetic level, stuff that's potentially passed on to your offspring. So really fascinating stuff for the skeptics out there. Read Altered Traits. It's a really good, really good book. So getting back to some of your other points, enjoying the journey can be really tough. And I'll tell you, listen, there's stresses in residency. There's going to be stresses in fellowship. There's stresses as a faculty member and as an attending. The one thing that changes, residents have less control of their time. So how do you find time for this? How do you enjoy the journey when you have a little bit less control of what your day-to-day is and minute-to-minute?
I think it goes back to prioritization, what's important to you, and how you want to use that time. You know, for me, part of wellness and part of having the ability to be mindful is being rested. So for me, I prioritize sleep above pretty much everything else. I get a good at least 7-8 hours of sleep every night for the most part, maybe not in the past 7 weeks, but before then, in order to be rested and perform optimally, I had made the choice that sleep was important. So even if I have deadlines, even if I have a project or a presentation that I have to finish, for the most part, I will make sure that I work into my schedule, getting good sleep and being rested. And so a lot of that goes back to what decisions you make. And if you're feeling stressed out at work and feeling like, you know, you're just treading water a little bit, I think it's important to take a step back and look at what your priorities are and what decisions you need to make in order to achieve those priorities.
That's a great point. You know, I don't think we stress rest enough, right? In surgery and classic surgical training, it was be in the hospital as often as possible, spend as much time here, see as many patients, as many surgeries. And there's some merit to seeing and doing as much as you can. But I think the science is also growing and really supporting. We are much more effective learners when we are well-rested and not stressed out. And there are real flaws in that, you know, kind of, I'm sure you've heard attendings say, and I heard people say, you know, the only problem with Q2 overnight call is that you miss, you know, half the cases, right? And there's something really flawed in that, because if you're exhausted and tired, you're not taking in everything you could take in, and you're not being present. You're not in the moment. You're not kind of gathering all of the information that's around you.
Yeah. When I was younger, my mom would be on my case all the time about driving when I was sleep deprived. And she would say, you know, you're driving drunk. And I was like, no, I'm not. I'm just tired. And she said, yeah, well, if you're not getting adequate rest, that's pretty much the same thing. And I think there's actually some research on that now about how well you're able to synthesize information, how well you have your critical decision-making and your prefrontal cortex, how well that's working when you're sleep deprived. And so, yeah, I agree. There definitely is some utility in working long hours, but there also is some utility in really learning the importance of running fast for a little while and then slowing down, and running fast and then slowing down. And in that way, you can really achieve a lot in those short spurts and then give your body and your mind time to rest, so that when you go back to work, you're really refreshed and able to make those good decisions.
Yeah. you know, you were a competitive athlete. You played sports for a long time. And I don't know how you were trained, but I was trained in the era where, exactly like you said, you run as fast as you can for as long as you can, and you lift as much weights for as many times as you can. And if you go to personal and professional trainers now, that's not the way athletes train anymore. You work really hard and then you rest, because you can't work really hard in the next repetition if your body's fatigued and tired and you haven't given it time to kind of do all of the micro things that need to happen at a muscular and biological level to actually enhance your abilities. And I think the same thing's true for our mental capabilities.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I've taken from your podcast actually recently is the concept of breaks during, you know, long days or long cases. How do you, in your teaching of residents, how do you implement that on a daily basis? Do you encourage your residents to take breaks in the middle of a big case?
I do. I ask, when we're doing long cases, I routinely ask if people want to use the restroom. And I will tell you routinely in a long case, I will use the restroom. And I think it's a great opportunity. First of all, listen, we're urologists. We should be kind of not holding our, you know, urinary function for a while. But I think it's a great way to refresh. You walk out of the operating room, you clear your head, kind of refocus, revisualize the things that are going on, and come back to it. Now, listen, you don't leave in the middle of a critical portion or when things are tricky, but I think patients would actually be more respectful of a surgeon who takes the time to come back to them and is truly focused, leaves them with somebody safe and competent team, and then comes back to them fully focused and into it. And I try and encourage the same thing in the trainees and residents. And I tell them, even though they don't always believe me, it's not a sign of weakness to leave. It's okay to go to the bathroom. We will wait for you, right? You know, go take 3 to 5 minutes. It's really important for yourself to be totally in the game, totally be in the surgery, and to be fully there. And to your point of presence, you're not really present if your back hurts or your neck hurts, or you've got to go to the bathroom because you're thinking about how to push these other things out of your mind than being 100% focused on the task at hand and the person on the table underneath you.
Yeah, that's great. I will work on implementing some of those over the course of my chief year for sure.
Well, it might be tricky with depending on who your faculty members are, but we slowly work on people and we make small changes. We make small changes over time. Before we leave that category, I just want to talk about some of the tricks we can do to be more present in the day. I didn't realize what I was doing when I was a resident, but I was one of those people who kept kind of an old school surgical journal where I would put the patient's, you know, ID sticker in there and I would make notes. And I actually still keep them somewhere on a shelf back here in my office, but just as a reminder of all the things I saw and did. But very rarely did I actually go back and look at those notes again. But the process, I think, of writing those things down and reflecting on what happened in the operating room or reflecting what happened on the day really helped me be present and internalize what I just experienced. Like I said, I didn't realize what I was doing at the moment, but now in retrospect, I realize actually how important that was. And now I do that on a daily basis, not so much with surgery, but with my life. I write about gratitude. I write about important things that happened in the day. I write about what I want to do the next day so that I am present and focused and I'm not wasting brain space on that. I don't know if you had any tricks or tips for being present, you know, as a trainee.
Yeah, I'll echo your sentiment on gratitude. I recently started a gratitude practice myself of just in my phone, you know, jotting down a couple of words every day of gratitude. There's a lot of research and belief out there that just being more grateful on a daily basis can change your life in a myriad of ways. And I'm a big believer in that. In terms of where I hold stress in my body, for me, it was always my shoulders. So 5 or 6 years ago, I, in my phone, put a reminder. I think it was every day at 6 p.m. I put an alert on that said, lower your shoulders. I think it's still on there. I don't think I've actually deleted it. And it popped up on my phone every day for 2 years, 3 years. And I would lower my shoulders and it would remind me to take a moment, take a breath. Nowadays, I think the Apple Watch actually every hour or so, or whatever you set it to, reminds you to stand up or take a breath. So I think reminders are a great way to implement something that you want to change in your life. And for me, having that breath, having that moment of de-stress and lowering my shoulders really would change the course of the day sometimes. So I think that's a great tool to use as well.
Really nice. And I think that's one of the things that yoga taught me is where I carry my stress and body awareness. And I'll give two quick anecdotes on that. And, you know, when I first realized kind of body awareness when I was carrying stress, it was my jaw, my shoulders, and my hips. I'll tell you right now, my jaw is doing okay. My shoulders are okay. My hips are still a mess and incredibly tight. But I think that's one of the things we realize as you recognize the body-mind connections of where you hold your stress. And actually, by changing your physicality and getting the stress physically out of your muscles and joints, you can actually improve your mental state too. And I think that's one of the things I learned from yoga.
Yeah, absolutely. We are beings that hold emotions in different places about in our body. And yoga and mindfulness itself helps us be more aware of where we hold those things and where we might be holding certain emotions that we're not aware of. And as we work through those physical things, as you said, some of those emotional and spiritual aspects will come to light as well, which is part of the beautiful process, I think.
Yeah. And the other thing, just while we're touching on yoga again, I have to apologize. I just love yoga. So I have to talk about it. But one of the things I do work on in the operating room with my trainees is a little bit of body awareness. So for instance, you're doing a big open case. Most people feel it along their back and neck, what in yoga you would call your back body. And one of the ways to alleviate that tension is to work on your front body. So your core, your abdomen, kind of your chest, your kind of girdle this way. And so we'll talk to the residents sometimes like, you feel it in your back or your shoulders? And like, yeah, I really feel it. Okay, we'll work on your front body now and try and hold yourself up a little bit. You'll find your back and neck are a lot better off at the end of the day. So once again, body awareness and thinking, you know, in kind of some of those yoga poses and yoga principles, I think also really helps in the operating room.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the same way. I'm constantly telling some of my cohort residents to use their footwork and put their bodies in more advantageous positions for the procedure. Because, you know, we often think of surgery as standing still and not moving. Maybe that's the case when you're on the robot, but when you're doing your uroscopy or doing some sort of other surgery, we often forget about our feet. And so that's a good thing to remember of just changing our complete angle of our bodies also.
That's a great point. And kind of how you hold yourself up. And listen, robotics brings in a whole new, you know, realm of ergonomic issues. And you'll see residents and trainees wake up with a bright red forehead from pushing too hard into the console. And that puts tremendous stress on the neck, back, and shoulders. But you know, we'll get there over time and slowly kind of work with people to do that. The second major point you brought up was having compassion with others or for others. And this can be really hard on some days. It can be really challenging. And some people can make it really challenging to be compassionate for them. But we're in medicine because we want to care for people. We want to help people in some sense or another. So once again, I'm going to ask you practical stuff. You know, what are some of your tools for being compassionate, seeing for people when you're really having a rough day and you don't want to be compassionate at all?
Yeah, I try to take my emotions out of it. You know, and part of that is like we've been talking about is being mindful of what those emotions are. But frequently with difficult patients, we're very triggered on a deep level emotionally, whether it's because the patient isn't listening to us or because something logistically within the hospital isn't working out. You know, we're feeling all these different things. But when we're encountered with a difficult patient situation, and I feel like my emotions are getting a little heightened, I try to lower those emotions by taking a step back, getting some perspective, and asking the patient really what they want. Because at the end of the day, that's what we're there for. We're there to help make their lives better. And if we're being good physicians and explaining to patients the risks, benefits, alternatives of their care, then we have to give them the ability to take those options and make a decision. And if they don't want something, or if they are saying something that doesn't really make sense to us, that's okay, as long as we kind of discuss those things with them. And so I try to take my emotions out of the equation a little bit and try to see what they really want. You know, this happened the other day when a patient came in and his hemoglobin was 5. He had some blood in the urine. And I said, I'm sorry, his hemoglobin wasn't 5. His hemoglobin was like 7.2, and he had some cardiac issues. And I said, sir, like, you should get a transfusion. You know, you're at risk of an MI, you're at risk of complications, et cetera. And he says, no, I don't want it, you know, risk of this, risk of this. And I said, well, I don't think it's a very smart decision based on how much you're bleeding. And we came to an understanding of said, oh, we'll recheck it in, you know, 4 hours. We'll see how you're doing in a little bit. And he was like, yep, that's fine. That sounds like a great plan. Let's do that. And so although I didn't really agree with it, although at the end of the day, it wasn't, in my mind, the safest thing to do, it was what they wanted. And I felt completely comfortable going with their wishes because that was in line with their values. So I think it's very important to remember that at the end of the day, we're there for patients and to bring forth their values to the best of our ability.
Jake, I think that's great. And it gets to the point of what you kind of said before, which is meeting people where they are. You met that patient where they were. Sometimes it's really hard to do. And even on your best days, it can be really hard to do and people can really push you. And I think some of the important things are, first, as you said, recognizing what baggage you're bringing into the conversation, right? What's going on in your home, in your house, in your life right now? And that has nothing to do with that patient. So separate that. And some days it's just impossible in the moment. And when it is, physically separate yourself, right? If you can't separate the emotional or mental part of it, physically separate yourself, let yourself kind of gather, you know, kind of gather what's going on, and then step back in and re-engage that conversation or that interaction. And the last piece of advice I give to people is give people a gracious excuse, right? Most people are not inherently bad people. They're not trying to be difficult. They're not attacking you by any means, but they are, they may have something else going on in their life, or they may not understand. And so give them a gracious excuse, work towards a solution with them. I think great advice we're putting forth today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great way to put it, for sure.
Yeah. So we've talked about your upbringing and kind of your early exposures to mindfulness, yoga, meditation. We've talked through training. What's your plan for the future? What's your plan for integrating this into your practice? What's your plan for teaching others this? You know, does this have a place in your future career?
Yeah, absolutely. I think from a professional standpoint, I would love to start working more meaningfully in a focused way to share, as you have been, some of these techniques and practices that I know to be helpful with other fellow colleagues, bring it to different departments or institutions that I may be going to create a mindfulness program. I know that some institutions have it, and I think every institution has a wellness program that probably doesn't achieve what it sets out to achieve. But I think digging deeper into some of these concepts of mindfulness and yoga and meditation really do have great applicability to patient care. So certainly I want to bring some of that to my colleagues in the future. In regards to patient care, I'm currently working on a project to incorporate some sort of mindfulness techniques in a multimodal preoperative prehab program for patients who are undergoing surgery. So how can we optimize their physical health, their nutritional health, but also really optimize their emotional and psychosocial health before surgery? Can we get them to a better mental state pre-op so that maybe they can handle the rigors of surgery in the post-operative period a little bit better? So that's a concept I'm looking into a little bit more.
I think that's great. Really fascinating work. And I think it gets to your point too about meeting people where they are, right? Listen, what works for you and I on a daily basis may not work for other people, but bringing these concepts forward, trying to meet them where they are, I think there's certainly a lot of benefit that could be done there. And I think, listen, the reason we're here is particularly for surgeons, right? We are not, historically, we are not great about talking about these things. We are not accepting of anything but kind of hard data and hard facts. And sometimes we need a little bit, we can improve on our understanding of what else is going on around us and in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're kind of getting up on an hour here. So before we kind of summarize, just wanted to give you an opportunity. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up or talk about or let the audience into that you're thinking about in this space?
You know, Phil, I don't think so. I think we've covered a lot today. I think the concepts of being mindful, being aware, self-awareness, breathing techniques, I think they're all little tidbits that people, if they're interested, could take with them either in their personal or in their professional life. And as we were talking about before, there's no bar, there's no threshold that you have to do X amount in order to be starting a mindfulness practice. So I think we've covered a lot, and I encourage anybody and any trainee who's listening to this to give it a shot, even if they don't think they have time, you know, on their way home from work, just try some breathing, some focused breathing, see how that makes them feel.
Yeah, there's lots of, I do this with my kids. There's lots of fun breathing games you can play. You know, there's counting and finger touches and all kinds of things you can do, noises. There's lots of ways to incorporate breathing exercises, and sometimes it can be a little bit of fun. So Jake, I want to thank you for sharing your insights and your time. You have a really promising career ahead of you. I know that, and I look forward to being in touch. But for the audience, I just kind of want to summarize, you know, I think the 4 points you brought up before, I think are really critical for anyone considering mindfulness, but especially trainees here. First, enjoy the journey. This is a journey. Medicine is a journey. Our careers are decades long, and there's going to be ups and downs, and enjoy it. Enjoy the good things and the bad things while you're there. Have compassion for others and foster that sense of oneness, whether it's with your colleagues, with your patients. We are all in this together. Everything is temporary. It will move on. You may be in the highest of highs right now. That's not going to last forever. You may be in the lowest of lows. That's not going to last forever either. Things are in change. They will flux. And you can help kind of move that process along by being present. And then lastly, the breath, the last thing you brought up was breath and breath work. And listen, there are, I joke with my kids, there are two things that are always with us throughout our lifetime. It's our breath and our heartbeat. There's very little we can do to kind of get rid of them, but we can certainly modulate them. And you know, when we get worked up and our breath goes up and our heart rate goes up, that's a sign that there's increased energy there. So by bringing our breath and our heart rate down, we can harness that extra energy and use it for something a little more productive than just breathing fast and getting a little more anxious. So Jake, I really look forward to seeing how you're going to incorporate mindfulness with your colleagues and with all of our patients. I think there's a lot to learn there and a lot to see, and hopefully some really good things to come. So thanks again for being here, Jake.
Thanks so much, Phil.